Good morning again. So if you want to take a seat, my name is Matthew. I'm the lead pastor here, and mentioned at the beginning of the service, if you weren't here, that we're going to sort of transition from Christmas today into the new year. It's sort of an unusual time of the year, isn't it? I mean, some of us might still be full into the celebration of Christmas. Other of us might be coming down off that high. I hope you had a really great Christmas, whatever the case. And it was just wonderful to be here all together on Christmas Eve and welcome the light of the world. That's always such a special service, so thank you for being there. But this transition is one where we're sort of looking ahead to a new year, so it's kind of a fresh start. We all have that sort of sense, I suppose, of something coming, while at the same time reflecting back on this season of Advent we've been in and the wonder of the Christmas story, and sort of saying, okay, what now? So, you know, the light has come. What's the significance of this? And sort of in this in-between time, today we're going to look at the story of the Magi. I nearly said the three Magi. We don't know whether they're three or not, but the Magi. A wonderful story. We're going to read that in a second. And then next week, we'll look at the baptism of Jesus and compare that actually to some other experiences that people had recorded in the scriptures as part of Epiphany. So we're in this transition stage for a couple of weeks. I'm going to read this story about the Magi. It comes in Matthew chapter 2, so I'm going to read the whole of that chapter. And as we often say, you know, these are familiar stories very often because we look at them every year. So it would be easy to think, yeah, know this one. But in keeping with the season we've been in Advent, wanting to experience the story more, and particularly kind of experience the scripture where this story is recorded, maybe we can just sort of sink into this story a little bit. It's going to appear up on the screen. You can follow along with that if that helps. But you might also just want to close your eyes and try to experience it and hear it as if you're almost as if you're hearing it for the first time. Okay, so let's read. Matthew chapter 2. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Messiah was to be born. "In Bethlehem in Judea," they replied, for this is what the prophet has written. "But to you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel." When Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared, he sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and search carefully for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me, so that I too may go and worship him." After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen when it rose ahead of them stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their own country by another route. When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. "Get up," he said. "Take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night, and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." When Herod realized that he'd been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious, and he gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi. Then what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. "A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more." After Herod died, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel, for those who were trying to take the child's life are dead." So he got up, took the child and his mother, and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was reigning in Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. Having been warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee, and he went and lived in a town called Nazareth. So was fulfilled what was said through the prophets, that he would be called a Nazarene. Okay, so that's the story. I always loved this story when I was a kid. It intrigued me. It's got all sorts of mystery in it. You know, we've got these mysterious figures, the Magi from the East. You know, I sort of almost had in my mind like they were some kind of wizard characters. That really intrigued me. So it also confused me. It's interesting. That's a New International Version translation. But you probably remember from more traditional readings of that scripture that it says the star rose in the east, right? So you know, and I always thought, wait a second. If they're in the east and they're following the star that's in the east, they're just going to go further east, not west. Whereas the carol "We Three Kings of Orient Are" says westward leading, right? So now that word for east actually can just be translated rose or risen. So actually the New International Version just says we saw the star rising, or we saw the star as it rose, which is probably a more accurate translation. I don't know whether you think about stuff like that, but that would always sort of, it bugged me. I think, well, hang on a minute, how do they do that? They should have ended up in China or somewhere. Who knows? But there's also this sort of macabre aspect to it as well, which was very uncomfortable. All these children dying, and this horrible King Herod, who was so mad, you know. And I think we all know people who get mad and do vengeful things. We've all probably experienced that to some degree, or maybe we've done that ourselves. You know, we're just so angry about something, and then we act out in ways that just are totally inappropriate. Well, he's so inappropriate, and he just blanket kills a bunch of kids in order to try and get the one person he's after. And it's just horrible. So there's this mixture in this story, and there's, I think, a fair bit of discomfort in the story. We're calling today, "Blessed Are the Curious," right? Because there's a lot of curiosity in this story, a lot of mystery and a lot of searching. There's many journeys in this story, and maybe curiosity, you know, we can sometimes view that as negatively, right? You know, curiosity killed the cat. But I think there's a curiosity about life, about God, about people that can be really healthy and really wholesome and help us live more healthy lives. And these Magi are clearly curious, and there's some other curious people in the story as well, which we'll touch on. But we're going to sort of explore that a little bit. Just really want to talk about the three characters in the story. The Magi, there's more than one, we know that, but we don't know how many there are. There's Herod, and you know, we get a fairly good picture of Herod in this story. And then there's Joseph. We'll talk a little bit about Joseph in the story too. It's Matthew's gospel. We've mentioned this before, that you know, Matthew tells the story of Jesus' birth in a different way to Luke. This story is, Matthew's version is very much from the perspective of Joseph. It focuses on Joseph. It's probably hard to say it's Joseph's perspective, because Joseph never says anything in any of the story. You know, he doesn't utter a word. But it's centered more on Joseph, whereas Luke is more centered on Mary, right, as we read that story. Matthew's, you know, got journeys in this story just like Luke does. Luke, they're both trying to work out, okay, how does this man, Jesus of Nazareth, get born in Bethlehem, because that's where the Messiah is to be born. That's what all the prophecies say. And they have different ways of dealing with that. They tell different stories. So for Luke, Jesus is from Nazareth. That's where his family's from. And they have to travel to Bethlehem because of the census that Quirinius called. And that's, you know, it coincides with Jesus' birth. So Jesus is born in Bethlehem, and then they go back to Nazareth. Whereas for Matthew, it seems, and he doesn't specify, but it seems that Jesus is already in Bethlehem. You get the picture that Mary and Joseph are from Bethlehem. Jesus is born there. And then it's this flight to Egypt that results in them coming back, and because of fear, they don't go back to the hometown, they end up in Nazareth. So they sort of deal with this issue in different ways, but it's interesting to see these journeys. And Matthew shares several journeys. There's this journey of the Magi from the East. There's the journey on then to Bethlehem after they've been to Jerusalem. Then there's the journey of the flight to Egypt for Mary and Joseph, and then the journey back. So there's people on the move. They're on a journey, and that's sort of, you know, perhaps metaphorical for our own spiritual journey. I think we have a banner that says journey. That's the process that we're in as human beings, and the process that we're in together in terms of growing and becoming the kind of people that perhaps we can be. Journey seems a great metaphor for that. Matthew is constantly reminding us that certain prophecies are being fulfilled, right? We saw that in that scripture where he specifically says, and this happened to fulfill the scriptures. But there's an interesting, sort of buried in this story, are some interesting other Hebrew scripture references, or at least they're sort of perhaps alluded to. Some of those are, for instance, there's the story of the Queen of Sheba coming from the east to visit Solomon bearing gifts, and Solomon was the son of David, right? So there's these connotations of royalty coming to the people of Israel, to the king of Israel, and bringing gifts. That, you can read that story in the first book of Kings, chapter 10, read all about the Queen of Sheba. So there's some sort of allusion to that, perhaps, and that might be, there's other passages in the Bible, in the Psalms and in Isaiah, where it says royalty, foreign royalty will come to Israel, because Israel will be this place of justice and peace and mercy, and other royal figures will come bearing gifts. And Isaiah actually says bearing incense and gold, doesn't mention myrrh. We'll get onto that in a second. But I think some pretty it's pretty clear that the writer of Matthew is alluding to some of those stories, and probably that's where we get the idea that these magi were kings, because of that royal connection. There's also a really interesting reference, allusion to the story of Balaam. I don't know if you've ever read that. It's in the book of Numbers. It's about 22 to 24, I think. It's a three-chapter story. And the Israelites, so it's in the time of Moses. They haven't crossed the Jordan yet. They've been wandering around in the wilderness. And then they end up on the plains of Moab. And the king of Moab, Balak, says, he sees all these Israelites, and he's kind of afraid. He thinks there's too many of them, and they're a threat. So he sends, for some reason, he sends for this guy that he knows called Balaam, who's out east, and actually Philo of Alexandria, who's a Jewish philosopher, describes Balaam as a magi. So he's saying that he's like a wizard, a magician. He uses that same term for him. And this magus comes from the east at Balak's request, and Balak says, I want you to curse the people of Israel. And there's a sort of cyclical story where he goes through different iterations of about to curse the people, and then God says to him, don't curse the people. It's a sort of one of those ancient, somewhat laborious stories. But what he sees is a star rising out of Jacob. That's what it says. And so, you know, this star that we have in the sky, and this magus from the east, this sort of sense of that Israel one day will be a place of justice and mercy and prosperity and peace. This story kind of alludes to a lot of those stories, and it has that sort of almost legendary feel about it. And I think probably what, you know, that's how people wrote stories back then. Probably we shouldn't get too hung up on the details of the story and the literalism of the story, but rather what metaphorically is it trying to tell us about Jesus and about life, about us, about people. And so we're going to try and do a little bit of that today. Okay, let's talk about the Magi. The major, so here's a sort of classic nativity scene, which is, as we talked about this kind of stuff before, that's not particularly accurate, right? This story happens after the birth of Jesus. We imagine about 2 years after the birth of Jesus, because Herod tried to kill all the infants, male infants under the age of two. So he, you know, based on the sort of timing of it all, we think probably this is set a couple of years after Jesus. So we don't really have a literal scene of the shepherds and the magi and the manger and the stable. The magi don't visit a stable. They come to a house, right? So it's probably probably Mary and Joseph's house in Bethlehem. There's an interesting, you see the star up there on the top right, and then, you know, if we move on some other pictures, I think, of this sort of more traditional pictures, you can see that it's like a fireball up there. Do you see that at the top there? And there's some thoughts that the star may have been Halley's Comet, or Halley's Comet, some people pronounce it, which appeared about 12 BC, may not quite fit in with this timing, but, you know, we'll talk about the star in a minute. But you know, this story, the reason I mention this story has so many traditional layers over it that we sometimes have to sort of put those aside to get back to what really happened. And I think that's important with scripture in general, isn't it? Like tradition, we read scripture and then we develop traditions, and then we end up reading scripture through those traditions. And that's not bad. There's nothing wrong with that. But we have to be careful that our tradition then doesn't dictate to us how we interpret the scriptures, but let them speak to us. And that means having the courage and the energy and the intention to wrestle with the scriptures ourselves in our day, in our situation, rather than just assuming what they mean, because that's what's been that meaning has been passed on to us. Lots of other great, as I mentioned, I love this story. I used to love some of these images from when I was a kid. This one is a little freaky. You've got that mini little Jesus, sort of almost like an alien Jesus there. I always thought, when the Magi came and saw that, we weren't expecting that, you know, but that's sort of the way in that era, or, you know, a few hundred years ago, art depicted Jesus in this somewhat strange kind of way. This is one of my favorite images of the Magi, next one. We see, you know, this, I know there's something very, I love this one. It's got them, there's three of them, and we don't know that there's three. The tradition of there being three is because they were, they had three gifts. You know, there may have been three, there may have been more, there could have been two, but we know there's more than one. So these Magi come from the East. We don't know where they came from. There's lots of different theories about that. You know, the most widely accepted one is they came from Persia, or a particular part of Persia back then called Parthia. That, if we look at a map, actually, I think we've got a map, haven't we? If that's the case, that's the kind of journey they would have taken. And let's just leave that up, map up for a little second. That would have been about 1,000 miles. So that's a big. They travel a long way. There's other thoughts that because the gifts they bring, like the frankincense and the myrrh, which would have been harvested from the Arabian Peninsula, or you know, at least sort of northeast Africa, that maybe they came from the Arabian Peninsula, not as far away. And then there's other views that they came from even further east, that they may have been Buddhist or Confucian. And there are traditions, I'm not saying this is true, I'm just saying there is a tradition out there that actually in the window where we don't know much about Jesus at all, you know, we have a birth narrative, we have a little story in Luke when he's 12 years old, and then he appears as a man in his, you know, around about 30 when his ministry starts. So there's a whole chunk of Jesus' life we don't know anything about at all. There's some apocryphal gospels that sort of give a few stories here and there, but they're not particularly reliable. But there are some traditions that say Jesus went out east. Some people would say Jesus even spent time with Buddhist masters out east in India and in China, and that these gifts were brought because they're very expensive gifts, right? The gifts they're bearing would have been very valuable. And they're valuable because they're an investment, because they're going to pay for Jesus to come out east at some other point in his life. Again, I'm not saying that's true, just another part of the mystery of this story that I think is somewhat intriguing. And clearly, even though we might be a little bit freaked out about Jesus being influenced by Buddhists, clearly foreign people and foreign religions are being woven into this story by the gospel writer. So, and that's kind of unusual, probably, or might seem unusual. It's probably not as unusual as we like to think in the Bible. Another sort of thing I loved about this story from when I was a kid is I grew up in a religious home where astrology was forbidden. You know, you never read your horoscope or anything like that. Apart from this story, it was okay. You know, they've seen a star and they're following this star and drawing all these conclusions. So that felt a bit like, oh, you know, we a bit naughty, you know, in the story. But that sort of, that astrological view is brought into this story. These Magi, who, wherever they were from, probably are not royalty. I mean, they may have been, but they were associated with royalty. Out east, it was very common for kings and rulers to have some magician-type people around them, alchemists and learned people who would interpret signs, prophetic people. And they seem to be this kind of, you know, maybe wizard isn't all that inaccurate a term to describe them. I like to think of them like that. I don't think they had pointy hats or anything, but, you know, they're interesting characters. They bring gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And the significance of that could be that they're just very costly, but there's clearly metaphorical meaning to these gifts. It seems gold is represents kingship, royalty. Frankincense represents a priestly function, or maybe even deity. You know, frankincense was this very expensive incense that was used in temples and in all kinds of worship, not just Hebrew worship. And then myrrh is in this story, if you just read the story for what it is, that's a little unusual because that's an embalming element, you know, a liquid used for embalming. And so there's sort of foreshadowing here of Jesus' death. I mean, you don't normally bring myrrh to a newborn as a newborn gift. I mean, that's a little bizarre, but there's some foreshadowing here, and we kind of get that foreshadowing played out a little bit for us in the death in this story, when the what's known as the massacre of the innocents. So there's some darkness in this story, even in the gifts that are born by the Magi. But they've traveled quite a way. They're curious. They see this star. We talked about Hebrew prophecy earlier. There's some evidence that there were ancient Eastern prophecies that a great power would rise up in Palestine, in Judea, in fact, and that it would spread east and conquer the people out east. So it could be that they're keeping an eye on things out west, and they've been sent as emissaries to sort of check out, hey, this, you know, astrologically, or rumor has it that this star indicates something significant. We better go check it. There's these two worlds that are coming together in this story. The star, as I mentioned, there are some theories, maybe it was Halley's Comet. I really don't think we should take that too literally. You know, stars don't move or guide people like that, right? I mean, just if we have a literal interpretation of it, that's not how it works. So we probably shouldn't try to work out what they were. There was a conjunction, for instance, of Jupiter and Saturn around the time of Jesus' birth. We have record of that. There was a supernova as well, a little bit before Jesus' birth. I mean, those could represent, there's some evidence for that, could represent the light that is being described here. But more likely, it's related to that story I told you about Balaam and the star arising out of Jacob, rising out of Israel, that being a sign of hope. And there's an allusion to that here, rather than necessarily take it literally. So the Magi, okay, these mysterious characters, you've got to hand it to them, though. They were pretty smart, pretty determined, and they make this huge trek, and they go to Jerusalem. They go because they think this star represents the king of the Jews. So they go to find the king of the Jews, and the king of the Jews is Herod the Great. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about Herod. Herod was lots of different people, right? We use the term Herod for all kinds of people that we read about in Scripture. This is Herod the Great, and he was he pretty much ruled through the permission of the Romans, pretty much ruled the whole of this Judean area at this time. And he was a brutal dictator. I mean, he was very, very clever, a great politician, a great manipulator, worked his way into power very cleverly, kept this careful balance of keeping the Romans happy, because that's how the Romans did things back then. They didn't just come in and appoint their own officials. They tried to appoint local indigenous officials who they could control. They felt that was a better way of exercising power, control over the people. So, but they would keep tabs on them. They'd lean on them, put a lot of pressure on them. Herod did a great job of keeping the Romans happy, but he also managed to successfully manage the religious institution in Israel as well. He did that by a number of means. He murdered a lot of religious leaders. He also rebuilt or helped expand and restore and rebuild some of the temple, which was very important in Jerusalem, very important to the Hebrew people. And the temple was actually known as Herod's Temple because of that. So he kept a lot of people happy. He wasn't himself ethnically Jewish. He was from Idumea. He was an Edomite. So a part of just towards the south of Judea, where that during the time of the Maccabees, the people of Israel had conquered that area and incorporated it into their kingdom. That was some 100 years before the time of Jesus. So he had a sort of acquired Jewish culture, if you like, but he wasn't ethnically Jewish. And that kind of plays out a little bit when the Magi come to him and say, "Hey, where should the King of the Jews be born?" He doesn't know. He has to call in the religious people, and you sort of get this feeling that He doesn't believe all this stuff. He's not particularly religious. He's not a particularly spiritual person. He's just using religion in order to keep power and keep control. And obviously that's often what happens. That's one of the problems of political power, and it's one of the susceptibilities of religious power. So these they're described as the Sanhedrin and the high priest, the chief priest, the scribes, the sort of more intellectual side of the religious movement. They're all in cahoots with Herod, and it's fascinating actually that here are pagan, so non-Jewish magi coming from the east, and they are the ones who seem to get that Jesus is king of the Jews. And all the religious people don't get it at all. And the star probably metaphorically is kind of like revelation. It's revelation to people who don't necessarily have all the religious credentials or all the scriptures that we might think are essential to our spirituality. It's like God is speaking to people outside of that context. And ironically, the people who have the scriptures, the scribes, the people who are studying it and should know all about it, they completely miss the point. There's an irony there. And that's mirrored in Matthew quite beautifully at the end, where if you remember or you've watched the movies, I think it's John Wayne, as Jesus dies, John Wayne says, "Surely this man was the Son of God." Do you remember that one? I can't remember the name of the movie now. But you have at the end of Matthew, Jesus being crucified as King of the Jews. That's the sign over the on the cross. And a pagan, non-Jewish centurion saying, "Surely this man was the Son of God." There's a revelation that happens to him that all of Jerusalem at that time, because Matthew uses that hyperbolic language, he says that all of Jerusalem killed Jesus, just like he's saying at the beginning here with Herod, that Herod and all of Jerusalem were worried and upset and even outraged about the Magi saying there's a king of the Jews somewhere. He uses these two sort of almost like bookends to, I think, create some tension for us that we might miss it. It's possible to miss it, even with all the right religious credentials, and that the Spirit of God is moving outside of our religious correctness, right? And I think that's a beautiful thing. It's another thing that adds some of the enchantment and mystery to this story, I think. So Herod was this awful dictator. He actually died not long after this. We see that in the story, and his kingdom was split up between his three sons. A little map here just to give you an idea, so this is after Herod died. So we have Archelaus, who was a Herod, we have Antipas, who was a Herod, and then Philip the Tetrarch, who take over this area. They're his three sons. And when we hear about Jesus' interaction with Herod, or John the Baptist's interaction with Herod, it's with those guys, not Herod the Great. So Herod, you know, he eventually got killed. I mean, he died. He didn't really come to anything in the end. We can take that down there. Some things he did, though, which I think are relevant to this story, or might be relevant to this story, he killed all sorts of people, including his wife and two children, which, you know, is pretty shocking. But that might be why Matthew has this story about the massacre of the innocents. Because that's a little problematic, the massacre of the innocents, because you'd think that a story like that would appear in other historical documents, because that's pretty awful, right? That's pretty awful. And this massacre has been sort of described traditionally as being, you know, numbering in the hundreds, even the thousands of children. Now, a couple of points here. One, we're talking about the vicinity of Bethlehem at that time. Bethlehem was a small town. So, you know, if you do the math on that, then probably would have been around 10 to 20 males under the age of two. So, I'm not in any way saying, oh, it wasn't that bad. All I'm saying is maybe it wasn't as big a massacre that's going to make the news as we might imagine. Okay, so that might be why it doesn't appear on the records. It might also be Matthew's way of just reference to that's the kind of thing that Herod did. It's just part of the story, part of this. It's a very legendary story that Matthew is telling to tell us things about Jesus. It may be that it's a reference to that this is a child killer we're talking about here, and that kind of adds and heightens, I think, the sense of darkness into which the light is coming. and also I think heightens the sense of peril that Jesus is in. And there's a reason for this flight to Egypt. So let's talk about Joseph for a moment, because Joseph is the one who kind of leads the way and takes his family down into Egypt. And I think we have a little map of that too. This is probably a little easier to work out, although we don't know where in Egypt they went. But we're talking probably between 50 to 200 miles journey. I mean, it would have been, you know, a fair trek. But there's good reason why they went to Egypt. It was part of the Roman Empire and therefore safe, and they had a good road they could take to get there. But more importantly, it was out of the reign, outside of the reign of Herod. So they were getting outside of an area where Herod could exercise control, but still remaining in a fairly stable environment. And so Egypt became the place to go when you were fleeing, when you were trying to get out of trouble. So Jacob takes his family down there. That also adds to the story for Matthew of Jesus being this kind of Moses figure, right, who comes out of Egypt. We've talked about that before, where Jesus in many ways is portrayed in Matthew's account as a second Moses. The connection with Egypt is really important there. Joseph, as I mentioned, doesn't utter a word in the Gospels. He just has a heck of a lot of dreams. He has one in chapter one. And then did you notice that in that second chapter, he has three dreams. He doesn't really do anything unless he dreams it. And he's told to flee to Egypt, then he's told to go back, and then he's told to, all in dreams, then he's told to, oh, wait, don't go back there, but go back over here to Nazareth. So you sort of get this sense of openness about Joseph. He never argues with anything. I mean, he doesn't verbally agree to anything either. He just obeys. He just follows the directions he gets in these dreams. There's something I think beautifully simple about his responses. And he's been handed this really difficult challenge of taking care of, well, the Messiah, which kind of, you know, who wants to, you know, in your hands now, you know, who wants that responsibility? But also, if you just take that out of it, it's like somebody's trying to kill his child, somebody's after his family, and he has to work out what to do. So there's something beautifully caring and protective about him. We see that in the way that he treats Mary too in chapter one. But you get this sense of here's this carpenter, you know, we're told about him, who really is not a hero in the scriptures. There's just one other story about him in Luke's gospel when Jesus is 12 years old, and then we never hear about him again. And you sort of get the feeling that when you read about Mary in the gospels, that she's a widow. You almost assume that Joseph died, but nobody mentions it. He just sort of fades away into the background. But what a challenge he had. Who would want that responsibility? But he took it on. So we've got these three characters. You may be bored rigid right now, but I think it's an interesting story. That's why I'm talking a little bit about the story. But what's the point of this then? And there's, I think, all sorts of points that we could make. But I want to come back to this issue of curiosity and this sense of mystery and perhaps take that, this sort of both the beauty and the challenge of mystery, the beauty and the challenge of uncertainty that these characters are experiencing, and maybe we can sort of take that ourselves and say, okay, how do we deal with that? What's going on in our lives, or what might be about to go on in our lives as we head into the new year, and how can we be more healthily curious? And let's look at each of these characters I've mentioned. And we'll mix the order up a little bit and maybe try to relate to them. And some are going to feel more relatable than others. And I encourage you to sort of just, you know, you don't have to relate to everything here, but what seems most relevant for you? Let's think about Herod for a moment. There's one aspect to which Herod is not the least bit curious, right? He's not like, oh, there's another king of the Jews. That's really interesting. Let's find out. I want to meet him. You know, there's no curiosity on that score. He's more curious about how he can control the situation. It's like it's very self-centered. He asks questions, and he's got this challenge. There might be a rival. That was not part of his plan. But he very quickly goes to manipulation. He's manipulating the situation in order to get the best deal possible for himself at all costs. Now, I don't think anybody in this room is probably like King Herod, and I would not want to associate myself with him whatsoever. But to some degree, I can relate to that. Okay, to that issue of manipulation, or when difficult things happen to me, or I feel challenged about certain things in my life, or I'm made uncomfortable, that very often my first reaction is, okay, how do I make this okay for me, or how do I turn it to my advantage, or even how do I just make it go away? And it may be that we're facing challenges now, and looking ahead, we're feeling challenged, or we have certain burdens, and part of what we need to do is just let go a bit and just say, okay, maybe this isn't about me. Maybe something else is happening here, or maybe it's not about me turning this to my advantage in what might seem logical to me about what's going to be my advantage, but maybe I can just ease up a little bit and let this thing play out. Okay, so that might be some challenges. That might be a challenge for us. And I think, you know, it's very easy for us to become manipulative, right? We manipulate our circumstances and our situation because we're afraid. And it's clear here, Herod's afraid. He's really afraid. I don't feel at all sympathetic with him. I'm just saying, we are all afraid too. Joseph, I think Joseph, as I said, a really interesting character. Maybe we have challenges or burdens that we feel a little bit like Frodo holding the ring going, why did this ever come to me? You know, why did this ever happen to me? And that's an allusion to another story, by the way. That's not in the Bible. But how many times do we think, like, why is this happening? Why is this happening? And again, maybe it's, you know, Joseph's not a manipulator here. He's like, he's going with it. He's going with the flow. He's going to say, well, okay, so what? I don't get this. And I'm not sure Joseph would have chosen this pathway. A load of options are laid out before him. I don't think he's necessarily picking that one and saying, oh, that sounds great. But is it possible that we are facing situations that we didn't bring this on ourselves, we didn't ask for this, but maybe there's something, we've got to walk with it for a bit. We've got to go on a journey with it. It's like, rather than running from it and hiding from it, maybe we have this burden that we're going to carry, and it's going to produce something beautiful. I think of, you know, a scripture we repeat time and time again here about that Jesus saying, I'll bear this burden with you. You know, walk with me, because my burden is light and easy. Well, we know that we have burdens that are not light and easy, right? So we need the presence of Christ with us to help us bear those burdens. Maybe that's our challenge. We need to experience more of God so we can actually go on this journey that could have unfathomable, mysterious, uncertain, but beautiful outcomes. We've just got to walk the journey rather than run from it, rather than put it down and extinguish it. That might be our challenge. The other challenge might be more like the Magi. This is perhaps the biggest thing from the story for me, is that there's something beautifully curious about these Magi. There's something beautifully curious about whoever's writing about them. Whoever wrote the gospel that we call Matthew now, the Gospel of Matthew, they're writing about them in this very accepting, curiously accepting kind of way. So they're included in the story. But the Magi are from their own religious background, their own political background, and here they are coming to this baby, and their curiosity has got the better of them, but it's resulted in them finding out things that they never imagined could be possible. They're seeing the light of the world. They're seeing the one that would later say, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. I'm the bread of life. You think of all the ways we see Jesus now, they would never have got to see that. They would have never been part of the story had their curiosity not get the better of them. Now, I would say that sometimes curiosity kills the cat, all right? So there's, I'm not saying curiosity is always good, but I think perhaps we can go into the new year being more curious about our challenges, right? And that might be twofold for us here as a community, especially. We're going to continue on in our theme of experiencing God, right? Our theme for this year, beginning back in September, is how can we experience God more? Not just know about God more, not just understand more about what the divine life is supposed to be like, but how can we live it and experience it in a more profound kind of way? Maybe we need to be a bit more curious. Maybe we need to be less contained by our religious traditions or the things that hold us back even from really opening ourselves up to a deeper experience. And we might be, our curiosity might be aroused about certain things that come up over this next year. And I encourage you, pursue that curiosity. Open your mind, open your heart. If God is with us, then God is with us. If God can bring in Magi from the East into a story like this, then I think that's a message to us that curiosity is a good thing. The other thing we can be, I think, is curious about other people. We're going into an election year, right? And it's going to be, I think, a whole, well, I don't know what it's going to be like, but I think we're in for a ride, right? We know that. And it can be tense and difficult, and in the midst of that tension and difficulty, we can fall out with people, and we can have difficult conversations and not have them very well. And we all know that stuff. And I'm not saying that we should allow our year to be dominated by a political election, but it's going to come at us whether we want to or not. And there's loads of other situations where we experience conflict and difficulty. Maybe we can be curious about the other person. I'm not saying we should agree with them, okay, or validate their opinion necessarily, but maybe we can be more on the side of asking questions about tell me why you think that. Tell me more about your story. Maybe we can be curious to find why do some people think so differently to us? Why do some people act so differently to us? And create some space where maybe light can come and the light of the world can shine so that we can get to a deeper understanding, but more truth, more goodness, more justice, more peace, rather than faking it or just avoiding it. Okay, so curiosity is, I think, an attribute that can take us to some really good places. Hopefully some or one of those might be relevant to you. I kind of feel in different ways all three, to be honest, are relevant to me. I can even, as I'm talking, think of different situations where I'm like, oh, yeah, I personally need to pay attention to this. So we're going to have a sort of moment of reflection. We often do that here through communion, which we'll take now. This is an ancient...